On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Joined in studio by Larry Donnelly, who's a law lecturer at NUI Galway, and by Elaine Loughlin, deputy political editor of the Irish Examiner, going through this morning's newspapers. And Elaine, you have been struck by the same line that I was struck by in Philip Ryan's piece on the front page of this morning's Sunday Independent.
Yes, and it's based on NEFED advice from last week that maybe we should be a bit more cautious about reopening and returning to work in September, as has been flagged by the government for many months now, that they want to get people back in the office as soon as possible. And they've stated September as that the date they have in mind. But one source told Philip Ryan in the front of the Sindo that because of this, the government may be forced to make a political decision on this. And it struck me, it struck you, Gavin.
what cabinet decisions are not political?
Exactly. Yeah. And as a cabinet minister, your main role should be, I would have assumed, is to make political decisions. They're tough decisions sometimes and they're not palatable, but that's kind of the deal when you get a job as a minister, I would have thought.
You'd have thought. And again, it's framed under this headline. I know that Philip is not responsible for the way that cabinet ministers frame their own decisions, but the headline says, cabinet unhappy as delay in reopening on the cards, as if cabinet are somehow bystanders in decisions to make reopenings. Why is it that cabinet ministers might be so reticent to go against NEFED's advice on this when they've been perfectly happy to go against it on other areas like international travel?
And they have been making a point, government up until now, that NEFED is an advisory body and that they take the advice on board and they make the decisions themselves. But clearly this source doesn't really believe that or seems not to. And we did have academic research out recently that came to that conclusion as well, that really NEFED and other health advisors, shall we call them, were really making the decisions over the past 18 months to 2 years on this. But it is a difficult one, and we see that Catherine Martin as well got herself in hot water this week over the reopening of some of the last sectors. That's the entertainment and arts sectors. And I found it curious that the Small Firms Association came out on Friday lobbying on her behalf, claiming that she should be a full-time member of that cabinet COVID subcommittee. So I think when you have associations lobbying on behalf of a minister, it does raise questions about the minister.
Like, in fairness, it's a curious arrangement, the cabinet subcommittee, because like you understand that there has to be some kind of streamlined decision making and that you have to be flexible in an area like COVID in the times that we're living in. But it's also a subcommittee which not only doesn't include the Minister for Arts, it doesn't include either of the ministers for education. So when decisions are being made about your sector, Larry, about, you know, what's going to happen for colleges, Simon Harris is not a member of that subcommittee, nor is Norma Foley, who has to worry about the mass reopening of schools in the coming days and the coming weeks. The Minister for Social Protection by right is not on it as well. Heather Humphreys is there for the moment because she's the Minister for Justice, but she's not there in her role as somebody who's responsible for paying out the PUP and about 100 million euro every week. So it's kind of curious that some roles aren't represented as a matter of default. But I wanted to get your take just as a sort of a political observer about this idea that ministers feel like they are somehow bystanders in decisions that they themselves have to make.
Well, I think the ministers wanted the easy way out. What politician doesn't want the easy way out? They wanted NEFED to say, look, everything can resume. And they wanted to say, we can please now all the sectors who, as you've indicated, are pulling and pushing at us to get back to work and get back open. We can go along with it because we have NEFED's approval for this. And this is the nice, smooth sailing, easy way out. If anything goes wrong, well, look, we just followed what NEFED told us to do. We've seen in the past that the government has gone against NEFED's advice and it rebounded against them pretty spectacularly. The other thing I think that's in play internally here is there are definitely people at the highest level with very competing and different opinions about reopening and getting things started. So, for instance, the Taoiseach is very clearly more bullish than the Taoiseach is. There's no doubt about that. And I think some of those conflicts are coming to the surface. And I suppose in some ways that's inevitable. But the messaging, as we've discussed before, I think has been a little bit all over the shop. And that hasn't helped their cause.
I suppose that it's worth pointing out that last Christmas, which is probably the most high-profile example of the government going against the advice of NEFED, is not the only example, and I think it still remains the case even to this day, despite the European digital COVID cert, that NPHET's advice is against travelling unless you are fully vaccinated, even though the government is prepared to allow you to go on the benefit of a negative PCR test or a negative antigen test, depending on what country you're going to. Larry, there's an awful lot written in today's papers about the government's COVID plans and exactly where we go from here. Is there anything that jumped out for you?
I suppose a couple of different things. The Catherine Martin stuff, I think, is very interesting. But also Luke O'Neill's piece, as ever, trying to see the bright side of things. I think as we go through the pandemic,
and God bless his optimism, because yeah, there's so absolutely. Many setbacks.
Yeah. Absolutely, and you know, look, I think that his point, which I'll reiterate about antigen testing. I mean, he's been one of the strongest advocates for more antigen testing. And what he says is actually borne out by some of the things that are happening in the U.S., where some schools have already gone back. And there have been a spread in cases among young people. And despite the dismissal of a lot of those as very minor in a lot of instances, unfortunately, some of them are quite serious. And there have been a number of children with serious cases and who've been hospitalized for prolonged periods of time. That points to the importance of antigen testing. And again, you know, don't want to push the panic button here, but, you know, look, this new variant they're saying, O'Neill here says that it spreads like chicken pox in schools. So that's concerning. And again, it comes back to the point I made earlier about, despite what Mike Ryan said, and I certainly don't want to go off the record with him, who's an expert, but just despite that, I just wonder about some of these young people who are going to coming home to elderly grandparents and vulnerable relatives, whether there is a case for a booster shot in a certain cohort of people who've already been vaccinated.
Yeah, that Luke O'Neill piece is on page 14 of today's Sunday Independent, and it's a piece about the general role of COVID and testing and how exactly you try to make schools as safe an environment as possible. And he says, contact tracing and isolation remain crucial, and there should also be regular antigen testing in schools. In Israel, he writes, all 1.6 million kindergarten and primary school children will undergo antigen testing. If a student tests positive for COVID-19, that student enters quarantine, their entire class is tested. Those who test positive will also enter quarantine, and those who test negative can stay in class only if they get tested every day for 7 days. Students in cities and in schools in cities and towns that have a high level of community transmission will all be tested once a week. All of these things can be done in Ireland, but will they? For our children's sake, in the face of the Delta variant, we must insist on them. Otherwise, we risk illness, hospitalisation, and long-term symptoms, and even the risk of schools closing again, which would be very damaging. And it's interesting that Luke O'Neill's piece today is on top of an article written by Wayne O'Connor, in which we learn that Norma Foley has sought Tony Houlihan's advice on antigen tests as schools reopen. I can only hope that that request for a little bit of advice went in before this week, because it will be coming fairly late in the day otherwise. I suppose, Elaine, you can understand why the cabinet is so reticent to do anything before the reopening of schools, because Micheál Martin has made such a sacred cow about the idea of trying to get education back in as traditional a format as possible.
And I think going back to the antigen testing as well, you know, the argument put forward against antigen testing, we've heard, is that they're not as accurate as PCR, and also people may not do it right. And if you get a negative antigen test, you might, you know, change your behaviour.
You might act as if you're immune.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think really that's really patronising to the entire population who have changed their behaviour utterly and entirely over the past 2 years. We've learned how to social distance. We've learned how to wash our hands correctly. We know how to use face masks now. And we're very much aware of others and how this virus spreads. So to claim that we might change our behaviour because of an antigen test and we wouldn't fully understand that it's not accurate, I think is really, as I said, patronising.
Is there not something of a case to be made for that idea now, though, if we're in a world where most adults have the benefit of full vaccination, and if you were fully vaccinated and you take an antigen test and that says you're okay, that there would be licence for you to think that you're acting pretty safely?
Well, I think people, regardless of whether they've been vaccinated one shot or fully vaxxed at this stage, are still cautious. The majority of people understand that there are breakthrough cases that we heard about just a few minutes ago, Gavin, and they are not living the same lives as we were living before COVID. And I think that those types of changes that we've made in our lifestyles and our lives over the past year and a half will remain in place for some time to come.
Just worth mentioning before we move on, there's a piece in today's Sunday Times which observes that if there is a dispute between parents as to whether somebody under 16 ought to be referred for a COVID-19 vaccine, that basically each individual parent has a veto. So it only takes the insistence of one parent to stop someone who is 16 or younger getting a COVID vaccine. Whereas obviously if they're 16 or over, then they're medically independent and they have the right to opt in for themselves. Larry, I know that you, if we weren't already in doubt, you've been telling us exactly what you think about the interaction today and the intervention by the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who of course was a major part in the West's intervention in Afghanistan, who has told the Sunday Times that the retreat of the United States forces and under the command of Joe Biden is, quote, imbecilic. Discuss.
Yes, extraordinary language, especially coming from Tony Blair, who generally would be regarded as a big fan and supporter of the United States in almost every instance. Indeed, went along with George Bush's war in Iraq. Mm. Also, somebody who would be from the roughly same center-left political tradition or political mindset as Joe Biden. For him to say that, I think is really, really extraordinary. To use that word, imbecilic. I know that other people in the cabinet allegedly have said that it was gaga and that the president is doolally for doing what he did. Evidently, Boris Johnson is taking to calling the president Sleepy Joe.
Yeah, it's buried inside on page 2 of the Irish edition, but that in itself is, you know, given that we are now 7 months post-Trump, the idea that Boris is still throwing that language around is maybe not surprising, but still striking.
So it's you know, again, in you know, domestically for President Biden, one of his big cases was that he was going to be competent. He'd been around foreign policy, been chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, that it was not going to be amateur hour, as it was, in his view, during the Trump administration. But objectively speaking, I don't see how you can see it. And I don't want to make light of it. It was absolutely horrendous what happened, and the scenes that we've seen are just beyond shocking. But it has been, objectively speaking, I think a failure. His first major foreign policy initiative has been an abject failure. Now, there's a calculated political element to all of this, which is that most Americans wanted the United States out of Afghanistan. And even though Biden's own numbers have tumbled a bit, as have the numbers of Americans who say that we should have left, have tumbled a bit, his administration is reckoning that that's a temporary blip, okay, that by and large, when the time comes and the question is asked of Americans, in keeping with the rise of isolationism in the U.S., do you want our troops over there? Most of them are going to say no.
But how do you square Joe Biden making his televised speech last week and defending the idea of getting out and saying that, you know, what is, if we can't do it in 20 years, why give it 21 or 22 or 25? How do you square that with the idea that he stood up on a podium 7 months ago and said, America's back?
Yeah, it's irreconcilable. And as with so many elements of that speech, which I thought was spectacularly misguided, you know, he then said that we were never there to do nation building. That wasn't our purpose. He himself, and I think
it's
this
become
is
the purpose.
He himself, I think, Lucinda Creighton, I think, says in his piece, was saying that, look, if it's not nation building, then what is the answer? He said the alternative to nation building is chaos, is what he said in 2003. Mm. So he's all over the shop and trying to have it every which way on it. The reality is, if the objective was to eliminate the risk from al-Qaeda and the Taliban, to take out bin Laden, why is the United States still there 10 years later? Of course they were engaged in nation building, objectively speaking. They were. And it should be said that despite America's critics, and I'd be critical of American foreign policy in a big way, there have been some advances in Afghanistan, which sadly appeared to be repealed right now. And I think there's a piece in the Sunday Times, really interesting piece about the younger generation who don't know the Taliban and how they've really embraced Western culture. And it really will be interesting to see if there is an internal clash of cultures or how this all takes shape.
Yeah, I did hear it being observed during the week that, you know, this is no longer 2001 and the Afghan people have access to social media and they're more exposed to Western influences. So will a change of government, if you want to put it as benignly as that, will it change their lifestyles quite that much? Lucinda Creighton, by the way, in page 23 of the Business Post, writes that if the mission in Afghanistan was not about nation building, but rather narrow focused counterterrorism, as Biden now claims, then why was he just 1 month ago defensively stating that the United States had prepared government forces in the country? I suppose that the lingering question, and you could debate this till the cows come home, we will never know how differently it could have gone. But if you are committed to withdrawing, and if you've decided, right, 20 years is enough, we want to be out by and large by the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks, How differently do you go about doing it? Because surely once you've already declared that you're going to leave, you've given the Taliban basically a deadline by which, right, well, if you guys have yourselves in good shape by the date we're gone, then the country is kind of yours for the taking. And there's no way to get around that.
No, and this is, you know, I agree. And this is the heartbreaking thing about all of this is I think that, sadly to say, a descent into chaos was probably inevitable. That having been said, there are certain elements that I think definitely could have been orchestrated better. I think in terms of the withdrawal of Americans who were there, that should have been done at an earlier stage. And then even more damningly, and this is what the veterans of the Afghan wars that I've been hearing and listening to in Boston keep saying is there are tens of thousands of Afghani people who sacrifice an awful lot, who risk their lives to help the effort of the American, the
collaborators
allies,
in one way or another,
and whose visa processing has been delayed and put on the long finger for ages and ages. The United States had a moral duty and still has a moral duty to get those people who want to leave, to get them out and to provide them with refuge. And the fact that that wasn't done speaks to a major, major failure, not just by President Biden, but by President Trump and arguably by President Obama before him.
Yeah, and that's picked up by Marion McKeown. Actually, she's a very detailed piece in the Sunday Business Post today, and she mentions that there are 22 Afghans who are entitled to these visas and their families. So that brings the figure up to about 80 to 100,000 people, where there is an onus on the US to now get them out of that country, their native country. But unfortunately, they probably will be under threat if they stay there. And given the absolute shambles that is the evacuation of American citizens and EU citizens, British citizens at the moment, you'd wonder what will happen to those 100,000 Afghanis. Will they be just left there?
And the real problem is, again, one of the themes in the paper today is not one person who's remotely acquainted with Afghanistan buys this moderate Taliban messaging. The fact is, I'm afraid a lot of them are going to be killed.
Yeah, that there's all this very benign stuff saying that, oh, it's fine, we're going to allow women to continue reading the news on TV, and then a few days later they've already stepped in to stop doing it. So who knows exactly how this Taliban 2.0 is really going to turn out. You were telling us, though, during the break that despite all the question marks that are being held globally around the performance of Joe Biden and whether powering through with the plan of Donald Trump was the right thing to do, you're already telling us that in American press this has already gone off the front pages.
Well, now look, it's still a major story. But at the same time, it is being pushed ever so marginally. Even in the past couple of days, I've seen it decline as the central news story. And you would think America's longest ever war, 20 years, you would think.
Ending in abject failure.
You would think that would run and run and run. And it will to some extent. But I'm just a little bit struck by how it has been surpassed by other things. And this, again, comes back to the political reality that Biden's people are banking on, which is that Americans are so focused in on what's happening at home, and indeed a lot of the problems around inequality and everything else, that's where their hearts and their interests and their votes ultimately are going to lie. And at the end of this, because they are so insular at this stage and because of the rise of isolationism, which, by the way, I can kind of understand given decades of failed interventions around the world.
Why do we keep sending American men and women over to other parts of the world to die in causes that they're ultimately going to lose in?
Exactly. And I think that Biden's team are actually thinking that in time, it's specifically in time for the midterm elections next year, Biden's withdrawal is haphazard and horrendous as it was, might actually be a credit, might actually be something he can say, I got us out of Afghanistan. It wasn't perfect, but I got us out. And, you know, we were there 20 years, way too long, et cetera. And that narrative might actually work for him. We have a long way to go, but that's what they're banking on.
Well, there's an interesting piece in page 8 of the Sunday Times today by a reporter who has visited Scranton, Joe Biden's hometown. And he speaks to somebody who's sitting on their front porch who's defending the man who lived in her own house as a boy. Her name is Anne Curran. She's a retired professor. And she says, Biden is doing tremendously. We had to get out. If I'd lost a son over there, I'd be furious that they had to fight for another country. The other night when I heard him say that we wouldn't be there anymore, that was wonderful. So clearly there are people in Scranton who think that getting out, irrespective of how demoralising a defeat it might be, might have been the right thing to do. We've got a couple of minutes left, Elaine, and I'm struck by the front page of today's Irish Mail on Sunday. It's about a poll which suggests that Micheál Martin should move off the stage and not take over as Taoiseach at the end of next year. 55% of people say that Ireland taking in 195 refugees is too few. Are you surprised?
Well, given that it's been wall-to-wall coverage over the past few days, I'm not surprised by that. We do have a large community now of people who came here from Afghanistan since, or well, over the past 20 years now since the outbreak of war in Afghanistan. So there are a lot of people embedded in communities across the country and have made their lives here and are very much assimilated into Irish society. The problem, I suppose, is we don't have the capacity. And there was a detailed blueprint for asylum and that getting rid, I suppose, of direct provision published earlier on this year. It will take many years for us to implement. And at the moment, we probably don't have the capacity, unfortunately, to take in a lot more than that 200 odd people that the government has so far committed to. Now, there are indications that that number will increase and perhaps we may take in about 300 people. Mm. It's still a very small number. And I think that the Irish population, majority of people would take more in if we could.
If we thought that there was a humane system in which to bring them into. We will be talking to Seán O'Murray in Brussels a little bit later in the programme about exactly how Europe is going to get to grips with all of this. But I suppose, Larry, just on that point, it will be interesting to see exactly how you square the idea of the Irish public clearly thinking that the right thing to do is bring in these people who can no longer live safely in their homeland, while also really not being entirely clear about where we're going to house them or what we're going to do with them when we're finished.
Yeah, as ever, I think that the sentiment is there. The sentiment is strong. The sentiment is spurred by the images that we've seen in recent weeks. But the practical realities of how to make this happen, that's the difficulty. I would hope that every appropriate resource would be directed, because I think it's so worthwhile on it. The one thing I should just say, that the one thing that is striking about some of these poll figures and Fianna Fáil in particular is that despite that, there has to be some disappointment both with the Taoiseach and the party more broadly, in the sense that almost 80% of the people seem to be quite happy with the vaccine rollout and how things have proceeded. Yet Fianna Fáil really, as John Drennan points out, I think, in his piece, that Fianna Fáil really hasn't benefited. That the Taoiseach's numbers are mired, whether they were, they're still stuck at 15%. They won't be best pleased with that. And the other thing, again, just striking, that people seriously angry about Marion Gate and Sinn Féin continue to be the beneficiary of that anger at the political class.
And I'll finish on this, Elaine, because one thing that John Drennan does observe in his piece in the Mail on Sunday is that usually there's usually a support or an increase in support for government parties during summertime, because when you don't have the Dáil and politics goes into a kind of a semi-hibernation for summertime, that there's no criticism of the government and therefore government parties tend to do well. And yet this Ireland Thinks poll shows that in the last 5 weeks, no change for Sinn Féin, still at 30%, and Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil still at 24 and 15.
Yes, but it did, as Larry pointed out, come in the middle of perhaps one of the biggest controversies, certainly in the past 6 months for the government, the Marion Gate issue. So government were very much in the headlines when this poll was being taken, and not for any sort of good reason. And we remember that Eamon Ryan was also caught out for attending a similar sized event, a Green Party thank you event for his candidate in the by-elections. So both of those did not shine a good light, shall we say, on the government when this survey was taken.
We certainly live in very interesting times. Sorry to cut you off there. I'm afraid we are completely out of time for this hour. Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at NUI Galway, and Elaine Loughlin, deputy political editor with the Irish Examiner. Thank you both very much.